Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 121, Metacognition, Sunday, May 22nd, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Each week, I post links, photographs, and other notes from the show on my website, yarns@yinhu.com. Today's episode features the following segments: The Front Porch, Ever Expanding Skill Set, and so forth. Hello, everyone, and welcome. It's been a busy week gardening at Yin Hu. This past fall, we had more acorns falling from the oak trees over our house than I ever remember. The house is a replica of a Chinese tea pavilion, so it has a peaked roof and no attic. So when acorns fall on the roof, there's a pretty steep pitch, so there's the initial impact, and then you hear the acorn rolling all the way down the roof. There were times this autumn when it felt like Yin Hu was under siege. There were so many acorns, more than the squirrels could really deal with, and so many of them were left in the garden. And now the majority of them are sprouting into little oak trees. My understanding was that only a small percentage of viable acorns could sprout into oak trees, but it seems like every single one of the acorns left in the garden is going to sprout. It's been an unusually fertile spring, I suppose. So I've spent at least an hour every evening plucking little acorn sprouts out of the beds of perennials. It's much easier to do this when the plants are young, and if I let it go and they really take root, then you're pulling out little saplings and it's very difficult. So I found myself thinking about my projects and my crafting a lot more than I've been actually working on them. And this has intersected with a few other things that have been going on. Number one, I saw this fantastic film that is out now called The Man Who Knew Infinity, about the life of Srinivasa Ramanujan and his work in mathematics at Trinity College and his metacognition, his thinking about his own thinking, which he had never been much prompted to do, I don't think, until he entered a place where everyone was thinking very differently from him. I think this is also one of the benefits of listening to a knitting podcast, if you're a knitter, is that listening to someone else talk about her own progress and process prompts you to think about your own, and it can lead to bigger strides in your accomplishments. It can also lead to some unhealthy things like comparative behavior and things like that. But overall, I think metacognition can be beneficial. In my line of work, I often find myself helping teenage students to think about their own thinking and name and describe what is going on with them as a way of making strides or overcoming obstacles. In the last episode, I mentioned the challenges that I faced as someone who had more information about sewing than sewing skill. And one of the things I had considered talking about, but it didn't end up being in the episode, was a comparison between learning to knit or crochet, which I did with no prior experience, and learning to sew, in which I don't have a lot of experience, but I do have a lot of information. And Melinda, who is host of the Yarnder Woman podcast, was asking about the difference between those two. And she used a phrase, how our minds treat ourselves, which I think is a direct reference to metacognition. And the fact is that when I was learning to crochet first and then knit, my accumulation of vocabulary and terms and information was paced with the skill acquisition that I was doing. I remember the first session of the crochet class that I took at my school, and the instructor held up a knit hat and a crocheted hat and said, one of these is knit, one of these is crochet. Do you know the difference? I really didn't know the difference. I was just guessing. So I was a true beginner in that sense, and I didn't feel the same amount of frustration with myself that I sometimes do with sewing, because I know what things are. I know how they're supposed to look. I have this information and background experience that is sometimes coming into conflict with my actual skill. Knowing this and talking about it and engaging in the act of thinking about my own thinking is helpful. It helps me rationalize. It helps me set reasonable goals for myself. Saratoga Knitting of the Ichigo Abroad podcast mentioned on her recent episode something she's noticed about her progress with works in progress. She says, you know, she'll have 3 or 4 works in progress that's comfortable for her. But then there comes this point, at like a tipping point, at which she's at a critical phase of a project, and all she wants to do is work on that until it's completed. So the motivation kicks in, and then she becomes devoted to a single project. Sometimes I feel like that with sewing versus knitting. With knitting, I'm willing to work on something bit by bit. It feels productive to work on it for 15 minutes. With sewing, it does not feel productive to work on something for 15 minutes. I know that I need to devote larger chunks of time to feel like I'm getting something accomplished. We often talk about metacognitive topics in string theory, the school's knit and crochet club, of which I'm the advisor, and I try to get students to think even more deeply about their own process in our conversations. Last year, I had some of the knitters and crocheters on, and Celine mentioned something called mid-project anxiety. Clearly, she had been engaging in metacognition in order to identify that she's good at the start, she's excited about a new project, she's motivated, and this could apply to a crochet project as well as a school project. She's excited to get started. She's good at the finish. She's deadline oriented, get things done on time. But somewhere in the middle, she starts to have doubts or rethink her steps or step back and think, something looks weird. She needs to reconcile, is this just the fact that it looks like it's getting more difficult? It looks like more time is needed than I had originally planned. Did I make a mistake? Should I just push forward? All of these possibilities crowding her mind are what constitute this mid-project anxiety. But even knowing that is helpful, knowing and being able to name it, oh, this is mid-project anxiety. This is what I usually do in this case that helps me be productive. Celine, by the way, is working on a beautiful crocheted shawl. She has a Kristen Omdahl book of shawls. She selected one and she is doing an unprom or non-prom into New York City with some of her friends on prom night, is wearing last year's prom dress, which I think is so frugal and awesome. And she is adding this beautiful shawl. So she's been working on that and we've been watching her progress. In other string theory news, Emily, one of our members, is teaching us how to dye with Kool-Aid dyes this coming week. I will have some photos of our progress, and we have been granted the use of the foods room to do some dyeing. And we also put up a yarn storming installation in our school cafeteria this week. We had initially planned for this to take place in April, which is Stress Awareness Month and is very high stress for students with national testing and AP testing coming up just around the corner. Many students have a great deal of stress and anxiety in April. However, we got a little behind in our progress, so we just finished a beautiful mosaic of knit and crocheted squares that are all sewed together. And this is wrapped around one of the columns in our cafeteria. I'll include a photograph, as well as some knitted tubing that we stretched around and tied into a bow. It looks great, and we're raising awareness about the stress-relieving powers of the fiber arts this month. If you're interested in more information about this topic, I can recommend two sources, a book and another podcast. The book is something I believe I've mentioned before. It's by Betsen Corkhill, who is the founder of Stitch Links. She has a book called Knit for Health and Wellness with a lot of great information. She is the woman who surveyed knitters, crocheters, fiber artists about the health benefits of their craft, and she includes many of their remarks about this topic in the book. It's really fascinating. There's also a podcast called Teaching Your Brain to Knit, which is focused on brain function as it applies to knitting and other fiber arts. I think that the hosts of this podcast are excellent. It's clear the audio quality is very high, and I always learn something. The first thing I learned was to ask my students, what has your knitting been teaching you? And it's a great way to prompt conversation with the string theory knitters and crocheters. The front porch. As I've been gardening, I've been thinking about summer projects quite a bit. And I use my summers to do a lot of gift knitting. And I have been competing in Stash Dash, as well as the Tour de Fleece over the course of the past few summers. These are crafting competitions. They are more like a competition with yourself. And for non-knitters and spinners, these may seem like very odd constructions, but they are real events that generate a lot of excitement in the knitting and spinning communities. Tour de Fleece runs the length of the Tour de France and is devoted to spinning, either on a spinning wheel or on spindles. And Stash Dash is a construction of the Knit Girls podcast that spans the summer months. This year, it's a more conventional summer season, beginning just before Memorial Day and ending at the end of August. And during that time, Stash Dash competitors seek to use up or create, or a combination of the two, yards of yarn. So you might be spinning yarn, or you might be knitting up or weaving up yarn, but you set a personal goal and then you seek to reach that goal. I think the original goal was a 5K of yarn, and now there are additional categories. The 5K is my typical goal. And so I've thought about all of the projects that I wanted to work on and complete this summer, and I began to list them. I set up a project called Stash Dash 2016 on my Ravelry page. I created categories for knitting, crochet, weaving, and spinning, and then I listed the items that I would like to complete. I didn't put yardage or anything else yet. It's just the beginning of the planning phases. But Stash Dash and Tour de Fleece are definitely on the front porch for me. I'm thinking about them and I so much enjoy, I think more than making my own progress on these things, I just enjoy looking at the extraordinary output of other crafters. To see their photographs and to see these individual challenges, goals met, progress, frustrations, it's really motivating. And during the summertime, I'm not around a community because I'm not at a school working and in a building that's buzzing with hundreds and hundreds of people. So looking on Ravelry at people's Stash Dash and Tour de Fleece progress, and now also on social media, is a great way to connect with others during those summer months and to keep my own momentum going. Ever-expanding skill set. This month has been the most fun cooking with rhubarb for hashtag Power Pantry. Rhubarb people are just awesome people. I've been able to get the most interesting ideas. I feel like my mind is really being stretched and my cooking techniques and even my tastes are being stretched by the suggestions and the conversation on this board. So if you haven't been over there, you really need to take a look. The number one hit this week was a spicy rhubarb pizza recipe that was posted much earlier in the month by Karen from Iowa. She's Kunstknit on Ravelry. She posted a recipe that initially I thought, ew, that's sort of weird. But then I started reading the list of ingredients and it clicked. It made sense that this was the perfect savory application for rhubarb. I will link to the recipe she posted in the show notes. Then when I went to make the pizza, I made some adjustments because Samuel isn't a big fan of spicy things. I personally think following that recipe to a T would be excellent. But I wanted to use some leftovers in my refrigerator, and I kind of took this pizza in another direction. It starts with a rhubarb compote as a base or a sauce, and you simply cook the rhubarb and other ingredients down into the consistency that you would want a pizza sauce. I used a pre-packaged store-bought crust because this was a weeknight meal, and I was going for something quick. I think it would be much better with a homemade crust or super high quality store-bought crust. I spread the rhubarb mixture as the base layer or the sauce, and there was enough in the recipe for two, so I put half of that in the refrigerator for a later use. And then I topped the pizza with crumbled up Chev, and little bits of sauteed pork belly. This was something I had left over from a Mother's Day extravaganza. My sister and brother-in-law work in the meat industry, and so we often are treated to extremely high quality and interesting dishes during our family gatherings. We had pork belly on Mother's Day. It was phenomenal, and everybody got a little bit to take home. So I was looking for the perfect application for this ingredient, and it turned out this pizza was that application. I also put just a couple tablespoons of grated Parmesan cheese, baked that in the oven. When it comes out, I put a whole big couple handfuls of arugula, baby arugula, and then I drizzled a balsamic reduction over that. This pizza was delicious. It was the perfect flavor combination of savory, sweet, tart, bitter. It was simply fantastic. I'm looking forward to making this again without the extravagance of some of the ingredients. And the recipe suggests coating the little crumbled pieces of goat cheese with spicy chili powder. But I think using a smoked paprika, as Karen, who posted this recipe, suggested, would also be a good way to go. So the next time I'm going to try the balsamic reduction with the cheese and maybe sort of like a smokier flavor rather than spicy and see how that works. This week, I also made a rhubarb custard pie with mixed results. For the first time, I was using some lard in my crust recipe rather than my all butter crust, which is typical for me. I have long wanted to make a lard pie crust, but I've had trouble sourcing lard that I feel good about using. And I finally was able to acquire some through my mother. So my first experiment with it, I used half butter, half lard in the crust. When I made the dough, it seemed like it would be much more tender. I could tell by the consistency of the dough that I was likely to get a more flaky, yielding, tender result in the crust. But that's not what happened because I think of the pie recipe that I chose. I'm not that familiar with rhubarb custard pies, so I looked up a recipe, a couple different recipes online. I wanted something that had a great deal of egg in the filling because I had some beautiful eggs from my mother's chickens that I wanted to use. And I didn't want a lot of heavy cream or milk in the recipe because it seemed like that would take a really long time to cook. So the recipe I found required you to blind bake the crust for 15 to 20 minutes, let it cool completely, then add rhubarb. In this case, it was rhubarb tossed with a little bit of grated orange and some orange juice, which had an interesting flavor profile, and then an egg and milk mixture with a little bit of sugar in it. And then that baked. It took a long time for that custard to set up in the middle, much longer than that pie crust required to bake. And so the resulting crust looks fantastic. The taste is good, but it's very, very hard. I think if it had been an all butter crust, it would have been even harder. I'm not sure what the difference would have been if it was an all lard crust, but I think either way, the crust baked too long, and I question whether or not it was really necessary to blind bake that pie crust. I don't know. It seems to me like 45 to 55 minutes in the oven for a pie shell is enough for it to brown and get its maximum texture. And that more than that can really interfere with the texture and the crispness and the flavor profile. And it can also make the pie shell subject to burn. It spent the last 15 minutes with foil, one piece of foil sitting on top of the pie so that it could bake, but it wouldn't continue to brown quite so much. So mixed results. I will post the recipe that I used in the show notes. I think next time I will try the following. I will make an all lard crust, replacing all of the fat in my usual pie crust recipe with lard. And I will not blind bake the crust. I will make the same filling recipe, put it in the crust, and see if that will bake up in about 50 or 55 minutes. And then I'll see what the difference is between those two pies. We're eating the pie. It's a beautiful pie and we will eat all of it. But I think the result was a little bit disappointing. And it could have been because of the recipe that I chose. I would love to hear from experienced bakers whether you think it's necessary to blind bake the crust for a custard pie. And so forth. I'm pleased to report that I have finally begun work on the Kiyomi dress. I devoted a good deal of yesterday to getting started on this project and made progress much more rapidly than I anticipated. Most of the time I've spent thinking about the Kiyomi dress so far has just been dread, because even though it's a very simple pattern, I'm working with a very challenging fabric. First, about the dress. It's the Kiyomi dress, K-I-O-M-I. This is a design by Lotta Jansdotter in her book, Everyday Style. The dress has four pattern pieces, a front, a back, bias tape, and a belt. Optional belt loops can be made from fabric or thread. And it has a little bit of gathering in the front and is made to be sewn from fabric with quite a lot of drape. I selected a cotton silk blend, and I will be using what I feel is the wrong side of the fabric for the outward facing fabric. I say I think it's the wrong side because it's the more matte side, and the other side has a more silky sheen. I don't care for the sheen. I did not think that this fabric would be as shiny and slippery as it is. I ordered it online, so I didn't have a chance to look at it before I purchased it. And definitely the slippery quality is what creates the challenge in this garment. There's a little bit of gathering in the front. There's bias tape that goes around the neckline and around each armhole. And then there's just swing and drape to the hemline. In my case, I want this to fall just at or just below the knee. And then an optional belt. For me, it's not optional. I definitely want the garment to be belted. I had already determined the size of the garment I wanted and created my own paper pattern. Yesterday, I began by cutting out the pattern pieces from the fabric. In this case, having a rotary cutter was very helpful. This fabric is very difficult to cut with fabric shears because of the slipperiness. And I also noticed that putting pins through the fabric does mark it up quite a bit. So I used as few pins as possible, and I tried to put them in locations where I thought that fabric would be taken up by a seam. So I cut out the dress, and then I cut a bunch of squares of scrap fabric and spent a good hour or so just working with the fabric and getting a feel for the fabric. It's funny, I had posted that I would be doing this. I got the suggestion from my mom to just play with the fabric, iron it, try different stitch tension, stitch length on your machine, try some different thread. And Kathy Stanwood, who is horse kook on Ravelry, said, "Oh, it's like swatching." And it is like swatching. It's like swatching for a sewn garment. So I did a whole bunch of experimentation. I picked up some silk thread. And although I'm using more conventional thread on my bobbin, I'm using silk thread for the top stitching. That seemed to work well. I played around with the tension. I found out which setting on my iron was perfect for ironing out the fabric without overheating it. I found out that I could use steam on this fabric, which is excellent because making your own bias tape is really difficult if you can't steam press it, because it just doesn't preserve the folds that you're making. So I did all that experimentation, then I felt pretty good. So I started by sewing the tie, the waist tie first. I definitely had enough fabric to make that again if I messed it up. And that went pretty well. So then I progressed to making the bias tape. That is very difficult. But through some experimentation, I got that to work and made quite a long length of bias tape. I wanted to have extra just in case something didn't work out. I could feel comfortable ripping out the bias tape and having additional tape at the ready. Then I did two lines of stitching to do the gathering for the front. And then I applied the bias tape around the neckline and pinned it down in preparation for the top stitching. Just as I was about to do that, I felt like this is enough for today. And then my bobbin ran out of thread. So I thought, okay, this is perfect. It's a good place to stop. And I think what I will do for the top stitching, the side stitching, and the hemline is I will wind some additional silk thread on my bobbin. So far, the stitching that I've done has been more structural and, you know, using a higher quality thread. For the seams I'm creating, I think will make a nice line and a nice drape in the dress. My plan is to continue working on it, maybe complete it this afternoon. I like to let a dress or a skirt hang for about 24 hours before putting in the hemline. So my typical process is to do everything on the dress except for the hem and then save that for the final day. Since the event to which I plan to wear this dress is on Tuesday evening, this plan gives me just enough time for completion. And then, of course, I need to decide if the look and the fit of the dress is suitable for the event.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stone to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Kurt sings, a bird out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or liking the show's Facebook page, or joining the Yarns at Yunhu group on Ravelry. The music for the episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.